he's just got a great story, funny. This is the first time I've ever met him, so it's always good to put a face to speakers that you've heard over and over. So anyway, here's Adam.
My name is Adam. I am an addict. Want to thank the group, thank the committee for inviting me to come talk tonight. It's an honor and a privilege to be asked to participate in DAA. It's a responsibility to give back what was so freely given to me. Welcome to the people that are new. You know, if you're trying this again, if you don't want to be here tonight, if your sponsor made you come to this, you know, if you don't think this will work for you, I didn't get here because I had a bad weekend. You know, I had a couple of bad decades. And I don't mean to be funny. I mean, every meeting has their perpetual newcomer. You know, especially in a smaller community. You know, we see that lost soul recycling through the rooms over and over again. And I stood up in the other fellowship. I mean, this wasn't around 20-something years ago. I stood up in AA for 17 years as a newcomer. I was one of those perpetual newcomers. I had so many chips and key tags. You know, we know the drill, right? I could have played poker with them. I remember one secretary saying, give them back. Right? And I did that walk of shame over and over and over again. And looking back at that experience now, I thank God for the unconditional love of the old-timers. A lot of the old-timers in the other fellowship, a lot of them that died sober, that said stuff to me like, you know what? Don't even bother taking chips. Just sit in the back. Shut up. No, but in a loving way, right? But they made it really clear to me, and if you're new, I hope you hear this. They made it really clear to me that if and when I was ready, because, you know, they could see it by my demeanor, my lack of interest, my fidgety nature. They had the wisdom to see that it wasn't right now. But those old timers made it really clear to me that if and when I was ready, that the doors of recovery would always be open to an addict like me. And I think looking back at that experience, now, if I lived to be 100 years old, I could never pay back some of those people for all the love and kindness that I found. And the thing about DAA, this is like the only place that I can talk about narcotics and the big book in the same room and not piss anybody off. Right? I want to thank all of the speakers that came. I am from a home group that's dedicated to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been told this by my sponsor. My sponsor used to say to me, Adam, it doesn't matter who's wrong. It doesn't matter who's right. It just matters who's left. And one of the things it says in the other book, the 12 and 12 in the ninth tradition, it really says that if any member fails to practice the 12 steps to the best of their ability, they sign their own death warrant. I mean, we talk about being organized here, but the bottom line is that this became, like a lot of us, a matter of life and death. It is a matter of life and death. Eventually, I started coming to meetings loaded. The interesting thing about recovery 2021, if you actually see a person high in the rooms these days, people say stuff like, oh my gosh, what's he doing here? You don't see a lot of people loaded in the rooms, and I don't want to bash the therapeutic community, right? Which is now, what, a $35 billion a year industry, right? Right next to annuities in the Wall Street Journal, you know, which swoops people like me up in my most desperate moments, right? Throws me into yoga class. Craft hour. I'm making like belt buckles and bongs. Nature walks. So what I would do is I would go to 7-Eleven, I would get myself a big gulp cup, fill it up with liquor, go to the methadone clinic, and then I would walk into the noon AA meeting. You know, do some of my best sharing, right? It's kind of funny because if you ever really look at what all the treatment centers and religions have in common, they all send their addicts to us. So I start going through treatment centers. By the time I finally got clean, I'd gone through residential treatment for drug addiction and alcoholism 28 times. Not 28 days like the movie. This isn't Hollywood. 28 consecutive times. And I'm actually wearing that like a badge of honor now. I'm thinking that's what makes me an addict. And I remember telling my sponsor I'd gone through treatment 28 times, and he starts laughing. And I didn't think it was funny. And I said, you know, what's so funny? And he said, you know, that doesn't make you an addict. And I thought, you're kidding. He says, no, that just means you paid $500,000 for a big book. And I didn't think that was funny. And I'm not going to start citing and quoting pages tonight out of the big book. But page 101 of the big book says any scheme that attempts to shield the addict from temptation is doomed to failure. See, treatment was a great place to fatten me up for another run. Treatment has its rightful place in recovery. Even Bill Wilson had gone through treatment. Treatment may have saved my life. Treatment may have slowed me down enough to hear the message. Some people do not go through treatment. It is not a prerequisite for DAA. But if you're new here tonight, my experience after all these years is that treatment never solved the problem. And I always thought the problem was narcotics. I thought it was drugs. And I remember someone in recovery saying to me, Adam, if drugs are your problem, that bindle, that pipe, that syringe, that balloon, that bottle, if that's your problem, you're probably not a drug addict. And then he paused, and in the very next breath, he said to me, and if you are in fact an addict, the type that's described in the doctor's opinion, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, your problem is not drugs. And it was like a cruel riddle. I got loaded over that for years. I didn't understand what he was trying to sell me or what he was trying to explain to me. But what happened to me, like a lot of people in this room, and I want to thank all of the other speakers that I heard, what happened to me is very much like what happened to a lot of people here. I got around a group of big book enthusiasts. When all else failed, I got around a group of people in recovery that took the statements in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, turned them into questions, and directed those questions at me. It's called the Socratic Method. In other words, was I incapable of being honest with myself? Did I use because I liked the effect produced? Was I restless, irritable, and discontent by nature? Was that my natural state before I took a drink or took a hit or took a pill? Was my greatest obsession that somehow, someday, I would control and enjoy an eight ball? Right? Or a bindle or a pipe or a balloon? Did I pursue that illusion to the gates of insanity and death? And as I started to go through those considerations, if you're new, for the first time I saw the truth. It wasn't about Bill and Bob in 1939. It's about me today. This understanding that I had to have, this relationship, as I turned those statements into questions, I started to see the truth. And the most obvious truth, if you're new, the external unmanageability, it was clear as a bell. I was never able to live successfully with drugs, even as a teenager. I'm in eighth grade. I'm already pissing my pants, drooling on my desk, passed out under the bleachers, right? I always overshot the mark. My nickname in eighth grade was Space Cadet. I couldn't find homeroom. People are picking high schools. I'm picking rehabs, right? I mean, the yearbook's like most likely to overdose. But if you're new, the disease of addiction comes in people. It doesn't come in bottles or pipes or syringes or balloons. The disease of addiction comes in people. And the greater aspect of this spiritual illness, as Bill Wilson describes it, centering my mind, if going through the considerations in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous shows me anything at all, it shows me that an addict of my type, an addict of this type, cannot live without narcotics. Not successfully, not happily. And part of what it seems to mean for me to be an addict, if I'm honest about my relationship with drugs, is that I have a mind that will consistently take me back to that first bag, that first bindle, that first pipe. That's what it seems to mean. I have a mind that will consistently take me back to using. Every time I get released from an emergency room, a hospital, a fancy Malibu treatment center, right? Men's Central Jail. 5743, roll it up. I'm like puking my guts out before I get to my property. I can't even get to the release module. Once I've made that decision to get loaded, it's almost like this visceral compulsion to use. Sound familiar? Sound familiar what it's like to sit in a room like this, surrounded by happy people, and suddenly make a decision to get loaded? And there is nothing on God's earth that will stop me at that point. You think at that point I'm getting to that liquor store or that dope man puking my guts out with anticipation of that first hit? And you think at that point I'm going to call my sponsor? Last guy I'm going to call. And if you're new tonight, there was nothing between me and that decision to get loaded. Sound familiar? And if you ask people like me and some of the people that have been here tonight, all of a sudden between me and that decision, there is a whole world called recovery. It's about people like you. It's about the rooms of DAA. It's about a sponsor. It's about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's about a way of life. It's about a design for living. It's about a roadmap to spiritual success. Right? For many of us, it's about this mystery we call God, which in many ways is a product of seemingly unrelated actions that I was asked to take in recovery. For me, it has been about a deep and effective spiritual experience that somehow happened by taking actions in DAA that I did not yet believe in. But as I became willing to take actions I did not believe in, what happened is I started to have a perception in reality, a change in my perception of reality. And what I've discovered as an addict, it's not how much I use or how often I use. That's not what makes me an addict. But that effect in me is so powerful that when I get loaded, it changes my perception of reality. I heard one of the other speakers, a friend of ours, said she got high and it made her wittier, tittier, and prettier. Now, I'm trying to, you know, make that rhyme in male terms. But you get the picture, right? So what does it really mean? What does it mean to suffer from addiction? Part of this idea for me as an addict is I have a mind that will consistently take me back to getting loaded. It's almost like my default mode, like on a computer. And I live in a place now, Santa Monica. It's called Silicon Beach, right? And the reason they call it that is because we've got about 250 tech companies that have overwhelmed our city because of the weather. But based on that, I've had the privilege of sponsoring a lot of really smart guys, guys that write code, that build apps, that program computers. And we talk about the language that Bill Wilson uses in 1939 and how really advanced it was for that time period. Because we use the word program today all the time, like process. There's a lot of words in the big book that were really advanced for that time period. One of the definitions of a program, if you look it up in the dictionary, is very simple. It is a sequential set of instructions, right, designed to bring about a result. Now listen to the language, just like on a computer. What do you do when you get a corrupt file on a computer? Well, it's obvious. You install a recovery disk. And what is the function of that disk? It restores it, second step, to an earlier point in the process. See, it never occurred to me that effectively 10 and 11 are very much like a viral scan. That if I follow these very simple instructions, these directions, what happens is when I get to 10, I become mindful. I have an awareness of my selfishness, my dishonesty, my resentment, my fear. I'm able to watch for the lies I tell myself, watch for how I paint the red flags green, right? I'm able to suddenly start to bookend my day when I retire at night, again, to do a nightly review. Upon awakening, ask God to direct my thinking. And all of a sudden, I have this way of life, this design for living. The book calls it a thought life. And this never occurred to me. It never occurred to me when Bill Wilson says principles before personalities. It was our founder's future hope that these spiritual instructions, these guidelines, would have more impact than the sometimes untethered opinions in the rooms. And I love DAA. I love the fellowship. But even my family, my mom would have parties with 300 people. I grew up around a lot of really smart people. And just like the fellowship, in that there's a lot of warnings in the big book. In that second chapter, it says the fellowship is but one element in the powerful cement that binds us. And it said it would have never held us together as we are now joined. And if you're new, as you may notice, the fellowship gives me enthusiasm, right? It gives me inspiration. It gives me encouragement. It gives me hope, brotherly love. Some people actually find relationships and employment here. But if you unleash a character like me into a large group of people like this, God, my character defects thrive. Please, I actually get sicker in the fellowship of DAA without guiding principles, right? And what does that really mean? What it means is somehow I become more separate, more different, and more alone. And if you haven't heard that terminology, what that actually means is separated from God, right? Different than every single person here. We call it terminal uniqueness. You haven't heard that term? And alone. You know that loneliness, that ache in the heart of every one of us? Right now, the bigger the crowd, the more alone I feel. My own birthday, my own wedding. That loneliness at the core of my spirit that really has nothing to do with the proximity or closeness of other people. That loneliness when I hit that pillow at night. And if you're new, what that actually is my inability to connect with others. And you put a bag of dope in me? I'm calling people from fifth grade saying, I love you. Fuck, I go right into amends. Get me high. I'm at one with the universe. I'm standing on the roof of my building howling at the moon. Right? Couple more drinks, couple more hits. I'm okay with me. Get me good and loaded. I lose interest in selfish things and suddenly gain interest in my fellows. Right? I'm drunk dialing. See, narcotics like alcohol creates the illusion that my life is manageable. And my experience with recovery is unless I can develop that sense of comfort and ease that I sought from drugs through this process, an addict like me will never stay here. And if you're new, my experience is the view from the center of DAA is entirely different than it is from the outside. I can fall off the edge, I can't fall off the middle. And I never saw that. The disease of addiction is the only disease, when treated, that will actually leave the sufferer in a better position than if they never had the disease. I would have never believed that. I come from a long line of suicide, mental illness, and addiction. My mom's brother committed suicide loaded. My father's brother committed suicide loaded. And to be the weakest link in that family, and now 23 years later, the strongest link, because of the 12 steps, because of a psychic change, because I became willing to take actions here I never believed in. And it's so interesting because, you know, what I've come to understand is that addicts like me and the people I've worked with somehow seem to be the most spiritually hungry people I've ever met. Why do you think honor, respect, unconditional love, integrity, acceptance, why are they so big with us? Because they're godlike qualities. And I never saw that. I never understood until I went through this process and started taking other people through the process. The power that can happen through these 12 steps. I never saw it. It never occurred to me until I... And my sponsor said, he said, Adam, if you really want to learn anything in this life, and this is not going to turn into a seminar, but this is what he said to me. He said to me, if you really want to learn anything in this life, he said, the most effective way to learn anything is to teach it. So Stanford put out this study. They did another study on the 12 steps as recently that came out, that the 12-step programs were the most effective programs for long-term recovery of all of the other ones out there. But they did a study on the hierarchy of human learning. And at the very top of the list, the least effective way was reading, then audio, visual, then lecture. And at the very bottom of that list, the most effective way any human learns anything is to teach. And the second most effective way, to practice. And when Bill Wilson said, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to others and to practice these principles, he hit it bullseye. That if an addict like me fails to enlarge and perfect my spiritual life through simply working with others, simply helping others and directing other addicts to a solution, I will never survive the certain low spots ahead. So I started to understand when he said it doesn't matter who's wrong or who's right, it matters who's left. I started to gravitate towards people that had not only long-term recovery, that were happy, that had joy in their life. You know, me and my girlfriend were laughing about it today. You know, two newcomers together are like two ticks without a dog. You know, and I don't mean to be offensive, but I had to get around people that had long-term recovery, that had experience. It's like a soldier. Why would you go through an uncharted minefield without a guide? And that became so powerful that I learned to respect people with time here because they had walked through these obstacles. You know, we saw this rowboat. We were in downtown Knoxville. They got that little rowboat there. And it was reminding me of this story, these two old-timers. And they're going fishing, and they got a newcomer with them. And they push out off the river. And, you know, the old-timer realizes he forgot his tackle box. So he just steps out of the boat. He tiptoes along, and he gets his tackle box, puts it back in the boat, and they're sitting there talking. The other old-timer realizes he forgot his smokes. So he tiptoes out of the boat to the shore, gets his smokes, comes back in the boat. The newcomer's watching this, amused. So he decides he's going to take a leak, and he steps out of the boat and drowns. And the two old-timers look at each other, and they go, "Man, I wish he stuck around long enough so we could have shown him where the rocks were." And what I didn't understand is I got around some people with time around here that took me through the big book, that showed me how to really take these simple steps. It's like looking at a bodybuilder and thinking, well, you know, I want to look like that guy. And this is just an example. Maybe if I join his gym and sit around in the lobby talking about working out, I could look like that. That's how powerful the fellowship was. It wasn't enough. It was a necessary piece, but it was insufficient to keep me clean and sober. And when I look at 17 years of failure, even in the rooms, when I look back at it now, what I see is my defiance towards spiritual principles. In that original manuscript, if anybody's seen that, it says, "Rarely have we seen a person fail that's thoroughly followed our directions," right? It doesn't say path. Now, I don't like directions. I really, my girlfriend will tell you that. I will argue with anybody about anything at any time. I don't like being told not to do things I already don't want to do, right? Sound familiar? You tell me it's black, I'll tell you it's white. You tell me it's big, I'll tell you it's small. You tell me to go left, I'll go right with an attitude. Sound familiar? And then I'll blame you for eternity. Right? That's why we say denial's an acronym. It stands for don't even notice I am lying. Think about it. You could tell an addict. You can't tell them much. Oh, you don't believe it? Try sponsoring somebody. And what's so sad about that is you can lead me into the gates of hell, but you can't push me into heaven. And when Wilson says attraction rather than promotion, what I came to understand as an addict is eventually I'd come back to DAA on my own terms. Not because sober living wanted me to, not because my parole officer wanted me to, not because DCSF thought it was a good idea, right? Where I live on the west side of LA, they all get clean for the trust fund. But see, hope doesn't matter to someone like me until I'm hopeless. You think hope matters to me when I got $500,000 left in the bank, brand new sports car, little Harley in the driveway, boat down in the marina? Please, you wouldn't catch me dead in a meeting. And my experience is, if you're new, that God doesn't matter to someone like me until my back's against the wall. You know, I can remember getting shot in a little argument right through the center of my back, came out my chest, and I'm laying on the gurney, right? Got the paramedics over me with the paddles. All I know is God, right? Anybody been there? Get your head in the toilet every morning, dope sick, so sick you can't even make it to your wake up. Ever been like that sick? Who prays more than addicts like us? Come on. You know, doesn't make sense? Go to Al-Anon. No offense. But what's so interesting is I get a couple of days away from that bag of dope, a couple of days away from that experience. As soon as they put that little cord up my groin to make sure it missed my heart, I was out getting loaded the next day. that experience of desperation fades from me so quickly. Like Wilson said, he had that experience, and then he said it was blotted out immediately by worldly clamors. And I have to see that couple days after that experience, you have to write this whole chapter called We Agnostics to now prove to me there just might be a power? Are you new? Do you see the arrogance in that? I mean, I have a coin, and it says the greatest battle in a man or woman's life is not against his brother or sister, it is against himself. And if you're new and you question what it is that's blocking you, what is it that's blocking me from an amazing life? What's blocking me from having relationships at work? What's blocking me from having peace, from having a power in my life, from having purpose? You know, Dr. Harry Tebow, who's another friend of Bill Wilson's, he's in the third appendices of the book, another board-certified physician. He says the four qualities of an addict are grandiose, sensitive, immature, and omnipotent. And those are our finer qualities. Right? Stick that in your next Tinder ad. Right next to selfish, dishonest, resentful, and afraid, right? No one cares if the picture's good. But I started to see what it is that's blocking me. What is it that's blocking me? It's interesting because we're talking about the Big Book. In 1939, when the Big Book was published, the Oxford Group, and you can look this up on your phone later, Moral Rearmament, 1939, Hollywood Bowl. They met at the Hollywood Bowl in 1939, the same year that this book was published. 30,000 people went to that meeting. That's how big the Oxford Group was at that time. And we've all heard the word enthusiasm, right? It actually means theos. It means filled with the Spirit of God. That's what the word means. And they believed at that time there were four things that blocked a human being from God. And this has everything to do with what we do in AA. The first is a dubious luxury I will not forego. The second, a secret I will not confess. The third, a restitution I will not make. And the fourth, someone I will not forgive. And what they believed at that time is that if those things were removed from a person, the light of God, for those that believe, or the light of the Spirit, for the agnostics, would shine through that person like a beacon, and they would be forever changed. And what they called that at that time was a conversion experience. But those four things, the dubious luxuries I will not forego, it's selfishness, the secrets I will not confess, dishonesty, the restitutions I will not make, fear, someone or something I will not forgive. And it's so interesting if you're new, because just like Michelangelo, when they asked Michelangelo, how did you make the Statue of David? He said, I never really made the Statue of David. I just chipped away everything that wasn't David, and there he was. If you're new, we can only really kind of hopefully inspire you. That's all we can do. I could talk all day long about this. You tell a little 5-year-old kid, go in your room and straighten out your room, he don't want to do it. You tell that same little kid, go in your room, throw out all your old stuff, we'll buy you new stuff. How long would that take? If you're new, what if it was really true that I could get free from addiction? What if it was really true that if I just took a couple of simple actions that I didn't believe in, that I could navigate around the drama, that I could have a life that worked, that suddenly there would be the type of alignment that one of the other speakers talked about, that this channel that blocks me, that 10 would clear that channel, 11 would fill that channel, 12 would empty it, that if I follow some very simple instructions, that suddenly I would develop a peace in that 10th step, a power in the 11th step, and all of a sudden have a purpose in my life that was so powerful that I would look back and say, oh my God, how did I ever live like that? And I'm a guy that went through treatment 28 times. Just like Roland has it, I had the best therapy. I had the best psychiatrist. I had the best MFTs. I had people chasing me around because I was very gifted academically. And I couldn't get past a liquor store. Spiritual math, potential plus addiction equals zero. And with all that education, I was still running around in the fellowship, not understanding what I really had to do to get free. The disease of addiction is the only prison where the key's inside. I couldn't see it. And what's so sad about it to me now is that when I work with new people, it's like I just tell them, if you would just do what I'm doing, just for a month. People ask me at 23 years clean, why do you keep going to meetings? I'm like, why do you keep going to the gas station? Why do you keep going to the gym? Because the shower I took yesterday won't keep me clean today. It says I cannot rest on my laurels. That's a warning. So I do these fundamental actions consistently over a period of time. And again, what happens is it changes my perception of reality. In the therapeutic community, there's a thing called chop wood, carry water. I'm like, what does that mean? What has that got to do with recovery? And what it is this. If you live in a really cold climate like Antarctica, if you don't chop wood every night, you freeze to death. You will die. If you don't bring wood into that cabin every night, you die. You'll never do it twice. If you make it through the first night at 25 below zero, you will understand you will chop wood the rest of your life every day. If you don't bring water up from that river, you can't cook. Now, in DAA, this is the same analogy. Go to meetings, work steps, help others. Go to meetings, work steps, help others. Go to meetings, work steps, help others. Go to meetings, get a job, work steps, help others. Go to meetings, get a job, work steps, help others. Go to meetings, get a job, work steps, maybe have an affair, get married, help others. Go to meetings, work steps, help others. Go to meetings, work steps, bury a parent, help others. Go to meetings, work steps, help others. Go to meetings, maybe get a divorce, help others. But if you're new, part of the word spiritual is ritual. What I didn't understand, this word spiritual is not that deep. It's asking me to take actions in DAA I don't believe in consistently over a period of time. And again, it will change my perception of reality. This is just very simple spiritual math. Humility plus service equals gratitude. Gratitude is not, it's not a feeling. It's not even an action. What I've discovered is gratitude is a consciousness. It is something that is the product of actions I do not yet believe in. If you're new, it's so amazing. And a lot of us will really endorse this, that anybody that does these actions that we're doing over a long period of time is not only going to get an amazing life, you will discover your purpose. You will find out, like it says, that I'd been making heavy. That suddenly these problems that I despaired ever solving become easy to solve. The doctor's opinion says, suddenly I'm easily able to control my desire for using. You know, even in the other fellowship, because I'm just going to use this as a reference because we're using that book. They want to tell the other fellowship they have no evidence-based results, right? Really? Go to a world convention. Check out like 80,000 dope fiends and alcoholics traveling from all over the world. And by the way, you can't pay, your insurance won't pay for the airline ticket. You have to buy a ticket, got to get a hotel room, got to get a conference, you know. And you look at these 80,000 people and when they do like the out-of-towners, it's like the United Nations, right? We've seen that. It's amazing. And you think for every one of those 80,000 alcoholics and addicts, there's a mom, there's a dad, there's a brother, there's a sister, there's an uncle, there's an aunt, daughter, son. I mean, the people in this room that stood up with time, if you ask their family what they think about the 12 steps, the most amazing thing in the world. And you think we have no evidence-based results? But what is it that blocks me? What is it in the doctor's opinion where it's, and one of the things I was asked to do as a method of going through the book was to turn the statements again into questions. Do I really believe in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery outlined in the big book? Because if I don't, I'm never going to do the work here. That's a roadblock right here. Do I really believe these guys from 1939 have a solution? Because if I don't believe it, I will never do the rest of it. You know, I heard you guys talking about the bedevilments today. It's the same thing. If I can't see the bedevilments in my life when I'm not getting loaded, why would I ever have to do the rest of the work here? So what I see when I look back at my failure, even in the rooms, and I live in an area where we have many, many meetings, is my defiance towards spiritual principles. Thank God we don't look like our stories, right? I know, because, you know, the suit, You feel like an FBI agent up here, right? But out of respect for recovery, I got dressed up. But what happened to me is I got to one more treatment center. I was 120 pounds. I stunk like urine. My fingers were dirty. I had tracks from my wrist to my neck, both sides. I'd been on methadone maintenance for 10 years. And this isn't gutter bravado. This is just the way I came in there. I was going to a clinic in a nightgown for 10 years. And I'm sitting in that treatment center, you know, in the nightgown with my ass hanging out, judging the speaker. I mean, right, we're the only people that could actually be on the curb and still look down at the world. Right? I got two speeds, grandiose and comatose. And I'm strutting around the detox bragging about Robin Brink's trucks. I finally did my four step. It was a bread truck. It was empty. So I'm sitting there in this treatment center, and this woman comes in from the other fellowship. She's doing an H&I panel. If you're not aware, H&I stands for Hospitals and Institutions. It's a committee that brings meetings into prisons, treatment centers, detoxes, hospitals, anywhere where patients, inmates, or, you know, clients can't get to meetings. But H&I probably has one of the lowest relapse rate in recovery. And if you really look at it, they're duplicating what Bill Wilson did in 1935. So this woman's on this H&I panel. She's doing her talk. We're in the detox. You know that great feeling in detox? You let everybody down one more time. Some of you guys were just there. I saw the druggy buggy. So she's doing this talk. We're in the detox. And at the end of her talk, she looks us all up and down and she says, "If I could give you all the gift of recovery, I wouldn't do it." And I looked at her and I looked at the guy next to me and I said, "What a bitch." But then she said something that would later change my life. She said, "The reason I wouldn't give you the gift of recovery, the reason I wouldn't give it to you is because I wouldn't rob you of the journey." And if you're new, that journey to recovery, just like that journey to surrender that each and every one of us as addicts has had to walk, is personal. If you're new, we can't give you that. And I don't want to be divisive or offensive, but, I mean, if you're in a hot tub with a supermodel, a fifth of whiskey and an eight ball, and your daddy sends you to rehab, we don't expect you to be happy. Fuck. Right? Oh, my worst day clean is better than my best day using. I'm like, are you kidding me? But my worst day clean is better than my last day using. I mean, I have to get some perspective on what I'm hearing around here. You know, I was 17, 18 years old in the other fellowship, and the old timers were like, "You know what, kid, we spilled more than you drank." I'm like, "You know what, pops, we didn't spill any. That's why we got here sooner." When the pain of staying the same becomes greater than that of change, this willingness that we talk about, the gift of desperation. See, it's a great acronym for God, but if you're new, I could write all day long on step one. Until I'd beaten down that liquor store door at 5:59 a.m. over and over and over again, or paid the clerk at 7-Eleven $100 for a six-pack. Right? Or been at the ATM with a butcher knife. I used to do that at 3 in the morning. Right? Sold my girlfriend to the dope man. Bought her back. Until I'd done all those despicable, disgusting, diabolical things that many of us do on that journey to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, you think writing about step one was going to somehow help me? I had to have an experience with failure. I had to see how self-reliance failed me. I had to understand for me what it meant to use against my will. When everything in my life demands that I stand and deliver and I show up loaded again. And I draw a line in the sand and I erase it and I draw it in the sand and I erase it and I draw it in the sand. And it's almost like I got high for mind expansion and pain reduction. You know what I got, right? Pain expansion and mind reduction. The gift of desperation. See, no one could give me that. I had to have an experience. And my experience with the We Agnostics becomes the same. Just like I get some dope, I put it in a spoon, I use it, or however you do it, and you start to come to believe that that's going to work for you, right? You develop a trust over a period of time. My experience with the 12 steps and recovery and these actions are something that happens slowly over a period of time. It's even in the spiritual experience. It says what seldom occurs in a year of self-discipline often occurs in a few short months. It gives a very short time frame for what can happen by taking actions here I don't believe in. And again, if you take that bag away from me, you take drugs away from me, you have to give me something better. And my experience with recovery today is that it's been infinitely better. But it took work. I had to become willing to take actions here I did not believe in. It's like if there was a weight pile in the middle of this room and I drive iron every day, think I'll get strong? Absolutely. Does it matter how I feel about it? Did it matter what I thought? And what my sponsor asked me to do was take that triangle, recovery, unity, and service, and he asked me to turn those into actions, to contribute, to belong, and to learn. Then contributing is service. The more that I'm of service, the more I feel needed. It's almost like my spirit is blind. But if I take these actions, what happens is my perception of reality begins to change. The more that I'm of service, the more I feel needed. The more I show up at meetings, the more I start to feel wanted. That is unity. And the more that I uncover, discover, and discard that which is blocking me from God, from self, and from others, the more that suddenly, for the first time in my life, I'm able to give and receive love. That those actions consistently over a period of time bring about a change. And again, it didn't matter whether I believed it. All of my life as an addict, I had a feeling I took an action. Had a feeling, took an action. Had a feeling, took an action. It's almost like normal people are intellect over emotion. They think, they process, and they act. I'm exactly the opposite. I'm emotion over intellect. I act, process, and then think. Oops, 10th step. I mean, come on. We're the only people that burn bridges ahead of us. Sound familiar? So what does it really mean to have a psychic change? What does it mean to have this shift? And part of that roadmap is that, like that triangle, it's suggesting that my head, my heart, and my feet need to be moving in the same direction. My head is the steps, my heart is service, my feet are meetings, governed by really 36 very simple ideas. And what happens is the steps bring me wisdom, the fellowship where two or more are gathered bring me power. And by reaching back in my community over a period of time, for the first time, I'm able to give and receive love, which is like the spiritual malnutrition that I've suffered from. This somehow fulfills that. And I couldn't see it. I couldn't see it. So what happened to me, that acronym, the gift of desperation, is eventually I got to a place where my head couldn't get enough and my body couldn't take anymore. Anybody seen that kind of using? When my head can't get enough and my body can't take anymore, God means something totally different. It means grow or die. Then suddenly there's a fork in the road. Suddenly my hand is forced and I got two choices. We've heard about it several times this weekend. One is to go on to the bitter end, right? Blotting out the consciousness of my intolerable situation. And the other is to stop using. No, that's not what it says. It says the other is to accept spiritual help. Isn't it interesting? It doesn't say stop using. Faced with alcoholic destruction or stop using, that's not what it says. It says faced with this destruction or to live on a spiritual basis are not easy choices. Isn't that amazing? It doesn't say stop getting loaded. I mean, you do a survey at Walmart. Well, maybe not Walmart, right? Costco. Want to get a clean sample. You got jails, institutions, and death. No Walmart employees here, right? You got two choices, right? Jails, institutions, and death, happy, joyous, and free. It's a no-brainer. You step over to my cell in Men's Central Jail, and you ask me that question, I'm thinking, how about an alcoholic death? Right? Can I talk to my counselor, my parole officer, my MFT, right, get back to you on Monday? And I will minimize, justify, and rationalize that first bag of dope, that first drink. And when the doctor's opinion talks about me being in full flight from reality, me being an outright mental defective, if you're new, I had to look at the ways I defended my right to get loaded. Because that insanity, we talking about insanity is doing the same thing and expecting different results. That's not the insanity I suffer from. The insanity I suffer from is doing the same thing, knowing exactly what's going to happen and doing it anyway. At least the other kind of insanity, doing the same thing and expecting different results, at least there's some hope there. But I know exactly what's going to happen, because what happens with me is my life becomes so painful when I'm not getting loaded. I become so really frustrated and irritable and restless that my own mother looks at me and says, for God's sake, son, use. You were nicer. Have a cigarette while you're at it. And again, if you take narcotics away from me, you have to give me something better. So I look at the way that I minimize, justify, and rationalize that first bag of dope. How I defend my right to get loaded. There is a saying, God cannot use a man or a woman until they come to the end of themselves. It's such a powerful statement. And if you're new, what my experience today is the bottom is the same for everybody. I've had the privilege of working with a lot of people. A lot of people. From Yale to jail, Park Avenue to Park Bench. You know what the real bottom is for an addict like me? It's when I ask for help, right? Condition one, and the second, I'm actually willing to receive it. Do you know how many people ask for help, but then, oh, really? Every day? Meetings? Work steps? Call you at... Imagine this. I'll simplify it. I throw you a life raft, and you say, you know, I was looking for a blue one. How do you work with someone like that? And then you feel guilty when they overdose. There's people in this room right now. I know that frothy emotional appeal doesn't scare anybody. There's probably two people in here. Won't see 2022. This is the way it is. And what's so sad about that to me is that what I didn't understand, because I hear people say, I'm a grateful addict. I'm like, fucking, I want to puke. What I didn't understand is that it was me that was blocking me. That on the other side of this, there was freedom. You know, one of my good friends, he's down in Mexico a lot, he stands on this cliff in this beautiful hotel, and he's looking at the shoreline. And there's this little strip of water that goes out from the shore, perpendicular to the coast. And he says to the guy in the hotel, what is that? And the guy says, oh, it's a riptide. It's terrible. He says, you know, every year we lose like maybe 10, 11 tourists. And they come down. They're great swimmers. They get caught in this riptide, and they fight, and they fight, and they fight. And they just get tired, and they drown, even though they're great swimmers. And my friend Johnny goes, that's ridiculous. It's only 5 feet wide. It just goes out 10 yards. Why don't they just let go? And my experience now is having had a spiritual awakening, right? Not because I'm like some spiritual guy. I had a spiritual awakening because I had somebody take me through the 12 steps. It could happen to anybody. What this is suddenly I'm illuminated to the truth. It's like finding out my next door neighbor's a bank robber. I've been watching this guy go to work for 20 years. All of a sudden I find out he's robbing banks on the weekends. You think I could look at him the same? When I went through inventory and I went through the process of discovery, I saw that I'd been crucified between two thieves. Yesterday and tomorrow. And yesterday I have guilt, shame, and remorse. And tomorrow I have fear, anxiety, and worry. The product of the 12 steps over a long period of time is an awakening. It's like our spiritual, like a body of water. When they're perfectly still, they best reflect the heavens. I know how to get there with a bag of dope. But my experience as an addict shows me that unless I can develop that sense of comfort and ease that I sought from narcotics through this process, I will never stay here. I mean, if you're new, we're the only people that want a reward because we ran out of a burning building, right? You're feeling heroic. You gave up your big Saturday night in Knoxville to hang out with us. Jeez. You're thinking about, if you're sitting here thinking about getting loaded tonight, beats the hell out of being in a dope house tonight thinking about getting clean. Right? You're wondering when the miracle's going to happen? You're in like a DAA convention on a Saturday night. at the end of a pandemic when it's pretty much legal to get high, the miracles happened. And the government's giving away free money, right? I was told my recovery, my clean time is a gift from God. What I do with it is my gift back to God. That there are three prayers in this life. The first one is God help me, right? Dope fiend prayer, God help me. I mean, I'm doing the third step prayer on the way to the dope man. The second prayer, God give me, greatest distraction on earth. But the prayer I'd never said was, God use me. And Ben and these guys called me and said, would you please come and talk? And I don't even, you know, I heard you guys, I heard the people talk today and yesterday. I'm like, I told my girlfriend, I'm scared to get up there. You know, it's never going to change. I'm never going to feel comfortable at this. But there is nothing greater than seeing an addict. I mean, if you don't believe in life after death, maybe you don't realize it. You're looking at it. You're looking at it. For every one of us, every guy I went to school with, every guy I got loaded with, every single one of them are dead. There's like maybe one, if I'm lucky. And you know that. The people that are here know. If you've been around, you got any history with the people you got loaded with, they're all gone. And I mean ugly, violent, vicious deaths. And for me to be here 23 years clean, to have respect to my family, to have beautiful people in my life, to have a journey, a path, people I love, and to have passion, it's impossible. It's impossible. That's why when we talk about this spiritual hunger, this thing that we seek through narcotics, it is, I am seeking a spiritual experience. I am seeking something that I didn't. It's like Oz never gave the Tin Man anything he didn't already have. I know that's a cliche. But I remember someone saying to me, Adam, what are you trying to put into yourself that's not already there? That fucked me up for a couple months. You know, syringe after syringe of black tar. I'm like, what are you trying to put in you that's not already there? I'm like, fuck you. But one day I thought about that. What is it that I'm trying to put in myself that's not already there? See, narcotics is an artificial means to a spiritual experience. The 12 steps are a practical means to a spiritual experience. You take the bag away from me, you have to give me something better. How many people with long-term recovery did I have to hear say they came here broken the day before they died, they became willing to take actions they did not believe in, and now they have an amazing life? And it's not about cash and prizes. Puke smells the same in a Mercedes. Got nothing to do with that. I live in one of the most wealthy places in the world. $1,500 a square foot. A shitty, dirty little house is $2 million where I live. The dishwashers are millionaires where I live. No offense to dishwashers. But my experience is that this is something, like the book says, that when he said he was inwardly reorganized. It's real easy to talk about the external unmanageability, as we call them, the consequences. But until I really understand what it means to be an addict, not just that I have a mind that will continue to take me back to getting loaded, but I have something else that's going on here. And we were talking about it before the meeting. Silkworth was absolutely brilliant, because one of the things that Silkworth says, and we'll talk, I want to talk a little bit about Duncan Silkworth, because he also treated addicts at that time. And when he said restless, irritable, and discontent, by I think we have a new word for restless, right? What is it? Oh, ADD. I don't got ADD. If Ben here had $1 million in the trunk of his car tonight, I love you, Ben, but I'd probably follow you home. I have what's called selective interest disorder. I'm really only interested in stuff that concerns me, right? That's enough about me. What do you think of me? You know what I mean? That kind of thing. I have an irritability. You know what it means? I'm quick to anger. I'm slow to forgive. I keep score in every relationship that I'm in. Sound familiar? I remember everything I should forget. I forget everything I should remember. And then I got a discontentment in my spirit. And what that means is the shine wears off everything right away. It doesn't matter what it is. I got a brand new car. I've been saving all year for the car. I don't even get it off the dealer's lot. It's the wrong color. right? Get a new house. I'm not even out of escrow. Hate the neighbors. Hate them and their dog. Right? I get a new job. I'm making more money I've ever made in my life. I'm sitting in the office doing the math. Getting ripped off. Right? So we talk about relationships. Love of my life. 30 days into it, I'm already correcting her. So underneath this obsession, there's this maladjustment, this distortion in my perception of reality. If drugs is the problem, guess what the solution is? Abstinence. This is the Sober Elks Club. But that's not what it is for me. It is this distortion in my perception, this filter. And what this process does over a period of time is it changes that perception. Such a simple, simple idea. You know, now I don't want to bash the therapeutic community. I've said enough bad things about it. Treatment probably saved my life. I said that. But going through treatment 28 times, I started to speak a foreign language in treatment. You guys know what it is, right? It's called victimese. It's like, I don't understand how the drug bone connects to the jail bone. Right? I need a class for that. What do they call that? Relapse prevention. Kind of like I met her in rehab. I can't believe she drank. I knew he was a crackhead. Can't believe he stole my iPhone. Right? Met her at the strip club. Can't believe she cheated. No offense to the dancers. It doesn't say it works if you twerk it. And I don't mean to be funny, but what the book says is how I make decisions based on self that later leave me in a position to be hurt. If I do not connect those dots through inventory, I will continue to play victim long after I stop getting loaded. There's only one problem. Victims don't stay clean. Everything that I did in the 12 steps of DAA eventually brought about this responsibility. And that doesn't mean I can't change the past. It doesn't mean, and for the millennials, there's a lot of young people in here. The interesting thing about the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hear this all the time, I do a lot of, like, service work and treatment, and now they got, like, five different ways to do it. They got SOS, which stands for Save Ourselves, Refuge Recovery, right? They've got Smart Recovery, Against the Stream. And it's like seven cars in the parking lot. Pick one. Hope you make it. But see, the 12-step programs, and I'm not just doing this as a sales pitch, even from the clinician standpoint, works the best for the most. The majority of people that we encounter over a long period, and that was the Harvard study. They looked at the long-term results of people that were not just clean, but happy. And I could not argue with that. I was no longer in the debating society about that. So what the book's asking me to do is see how I make these decisions based on self that left me in a position to be hurt and eventually how to be rid of those. That for me as an addict, there's a big difference between the act of surrender that gets me into recovery over and over and over again and the state of recovery that's keeping the old timers here. And it's a completely different concept. It's kind of like watching a swan glide across a pond of still water. It's so beautiful, right? So effortless. It's so graceful. But you know what that little bird's doing under the water? He's paddling like hell. And if you're new, we have a chapter in the book called Into Action. You ever notice there's no chapter into feelings? I know the therapists hate that, right? Into thinking. And again, what I was asked to do here is be willing to take actions I did not yet believe in. And for me, there was a direct relationship between willingness and surrender. You ever notice you'll never see anybody more willing to work the DAA program than the guy that comes crawling through the back door of the clubhouse after a long, hard run? He'll do anything, right? 90 meetings in 90 days. First day out of treatment, he's got three sponsors. Wants to take the whole coffee pot home with him, right? We see that guy. That was me. 30, 60, 90 days later, I'm like, you mean we got to go to meetings every day? And like a prize fighter, I throw in the towel, and then I take the towel back one little piece at a time. I take my will back. And the very things that recovery gives me, the job, the house, the relationship, the car, are the very things that become more important than my recovery. My sponsor said there's a big difference being in DAA and on DAA, in the program and on the program. And he said it's kind of like being in a submarine or on a submarine. When the ship takes a dive, you'll find out if you're in it or on it. So what I do is I get clean and I start to build recovery around my big life. And the bigger my life gets, the more inconvenient recovery becomes. We see it all the time. And what I was asked to do is to put recovery first in my life. And if I could do that one simple thing, what happens is I build my life around the 12 steps. Very, very different way to look at it. And if you're like me, fear's not going to keep me here. And Bill Wilson says it in the book. Fear kept him sober for a bit. Getting a third strike, living on the street, being homeless, losing my big career, throwing away my education, right? Did scared straight work for you? Went right over my head. Now, the book talks about, right, the recreational user, the problem user, right? Big difference between a problem user, the weekend warrior, and a real addict. You get a real addict and a recreational user in a jail cell for, like, drunk driving, you got two completely different philosophies going on. You get the recreational user, right, on one side of the cell thinking, why did I get so loaded last night? Why did I use so much? Why didn't I take Uber? Real addicts on the other side of the cell thinking, why did I take I-74? I know the court card people never laugh at that. It's not funny, right? Should have stayed on Surface Street. You could have been home cleaning your pipe tonight. Weekend Warrior's wife says, if you don't get clean, I'm leaving you. Weekend Warrior cleans up his act, doesn't use in the house, gets a little Visine. If my woman says, if you don't get clean, I'm leaving you, you know what I'm thinking, right? I'm thinking about single life. I remember the first time I said that in a meeting. If anything gets in the way of my recovery. I mean, narcotics had me from hello. It was the love of my life. And if anything got in the way of narcotics, it was out of my life. And my experience with DAA, with recovery, is exactly the same. If anything gets in the way of recovery for me, it's out of my life. A woman, I don't care how beautiful she is, how much she loves me, right? My soulmate. And like I said, I remember saying that in a meeting, and there she was in the back of the room. And she said to me, you know, you don't look like an addict. Why do you got to go to all those meetings, honey? Oh, please, you're not speaking again, are you? It's the weekend. Then she tells me, you know that program, it's getting in the way of our relationship. So a couple months later, we're still dating. Now it's the big night. You know the big night, right? Meet the parents night. So she gets me a suit and tie, invites me over to her mom and dad's house. Out comes the exotic wine. She's like, honey, you can have one glass of wine. It's just a glass of wine. It's natural wine. Four more rehabs. I stole her purse that night. Went down to the hood and got an outside issue, right? Please. And she came to detox with a get well card. I know, I think I got four cards from that one. My poor girl. I tried to send her to Codependence Anonymous. She wouldn't go. You know why? She didn't have anyone to go with. I always tell the Al-Anons, they don't think any of this is funny. Can't stand to see us have a good time even here. So my mom had moved and didn't leave a forwarding address when I was in treatment. And one of the things that happened to me when I got clean, when I had about 5 years clean, I came back into her life. And I had a job, I had a house, I had a relationship, I had a car. And what happened is I was asked to take the 12 traditions of DAA and apply them to my life, to apply them to our family, that for our family's purpose, for our relationship's purpose, there was a loving God, to understand that neither one governed, that it was a democratic process. I was taught how to see that intimacy is not two people looking at each other, it's two people playing different instruments to the same music. And eventually, over a period of time, I started to understand how to apply the 12 traditions to relationships. Because really, the disease of addiction is a systemic family disease. And when I saw that, when I started to understand that, I couldn't be around my family for the first 5 years. I could not be around them. Every time I got around them, I immediately started to feel that anxiousness. And what happened is when I started to apply the 12 traditions to our family over a period of time, the whole family recovered. My mom became my best friend. My dad, who I hated my dad. My dad was never there for me as a kid. And a lot of bad stuff happened to me. And I blamed him. And when I wrote inventory, my father was I blamed him for all of my failures. And what I was asked to do with my sponsor is to go through this process. And I heard one of the other speakers say it. There's a part of the big book where it says, we realize the people who offended us were also perhaps spiritually sick. And then it says, although we did not like their symptoms, which is column 2, and the way they disturbed us, column 3, like ourselves were sick too. What I was asked to do is to take every single relationship that I had, every resentment that I had, and ask myself if I was capable of the same behavior. That's the only way I could prove like ourselves in that statement. So if I resented someone for gossiping, did I ever gossip? If I resent someone for stealing, did I ever steal? And I may not steal from you financially. I may steal your time. I may diminish you spiritually, emotionally, socially, in many different ways besides in the physical world. I resent an employer for exploiting me. Did I ever exploit an employee? So with my dad, I resented my dad for abandoning me. And this was the question. Did I ever abandon anyone I loved when I was using? And there it was. And behind that was a lie. And what the lie was for me with my father was the lie. And I just went through this with one of my sponsees. I had to tell myself that his love for me should have been more powerful than his disease. Because that's the lie I have to tell myself to make that resentment stand. And as I did that with each and every resentment, what happened is for the first time, I understood what forgiveness was. And forgiveness is releasing someone from the prison of my own mind. It has nothing to do with them. It also showed me that I was the spiritual prisoner of that relationship. And what happened through that process is underneath forgiveness, there's compassion. I had to have that. And behind compassion, there's empathy. And once I started to do that process through all the 12 steps, when I got to 10, 11, and 12, it started to make perfect sense. All of a sudden, I got a quiet mind. My sponsor said to me, what do you want from the 12 steps? And I remember thinking, you know, I want a yacht and a Learjet. And you know what he said to me? He said, if you work steps 4 through 7 and you consistently live in 10, 11, and 12, what you'll get is a quiet mind and a loving heart. And I remember thinking, what do I want that for? But if you're like me as an addict, the opposite of the quiet mind, and it's on page 66, is the mind that won't shut up. It's a mind that's up at 3 in the morning telling me I'm a loser. It's up 5 minutes before me every day. You don't need to go to those meetings. And the opposite of a loving heart is a vindictive heart. It's a prejudice heart. It's a racist heart. And again, all of my life I was crucified between those two ideas. And as I continued to do this process, I started to see that there's a way to navigate around the drama. There's a way to match calamity with serenity. There's a way to stay in fit spiritual condition. So, in closing, if someone did to me what I did to myself, I probably would have killed them. If someone did to me what I did to others, I would have killed them. Then I come to DAA and you ask me to pray to God. I didn't want God to find out where I was. I'd become bankrupt in those really simple relationships. If you're new, if you really look at the 12 steps, by design, they remedy those three relationships. Steps 1 through 3, recreate and develop a relationship with God. Steps 4 through 7, recreate and develop a relationship with self. Steps 8 and 9, recreate and develop a relationship with others. Very simple idea. 10 maintains, develops, and grows my relationship with self. 11 maintains, develops, and grows my relationship with God. 12 through service maintains, develops, and grows my relationship with others. So coming out of the steps, a selfish, self-centered addict like me is not only easily able to control my desire for drugs, that's right out of the doctor's opinion, but for the first time in my life, I'm able to live in harmony with God, with self, and with others. There was a great spiritual teacher. He was asked, what's the most important thing of all your teachings? He said, love God with all thy heart, love thy neighbor as thyself. And you know what? If God scares you out of DAA and you're a real addict, don't worry about it. Dope man will scare you back in. So in 1 through 3, I give it up. 4 through 7, I clean it up. 8 and 9, I make it up. 10, 11, and 12, I keep it up. Very simple idea. So recently I was at an airport. I fly a lot, and this guy comes up to me, comes running up to me at LAX. He's wearing a Slingshot T-shirt, full body tattoo, and he says to me, "You don't remember me, do you, bro?" And I looked at him, and I thought, "No, I don't remember you." I thought he was going to hit me up for money, right? And he's got these two little kids with him, and this lady that's standing by his side, and he paused, and what he said to me, he said, 15 years ago, you spoke on a prison panel, and something you said changed my life. These are my beautiful daughters. This is my amazing wife. We want to thank you. And now they're hugging me. I mean, we're all hugging in this airport. I'm crying with these strangers. I remember calling my sponsor. My sponsor goes, "Adam, you got a big mouth and a good memory. Don't let it go to your head." Click. But if you're new, there's two dates in a human being's life: the day they're born and the day they find out why. And all of my life, I thought it was about getting the big job, getting the trophies, getting the little boat, getting the nice sports car. But that day, I started to see a different purpose. That really, that irritability and that 10 step, that's the 10th step. It gives me peace. The restlessness, be still and know that I am God, that 11th step. And that purpose, that purpose in that 12 step. So one of the things that happened to me when I got out of that 28th residential treatment center, right? The guy that was running the detox said, "Why don't you come back to our little hospital next week and tell all the patients here how you managed to stay sober an entire week if you can make it?" And then he pretty much escorted me off the property and dismissed me. So I was like, you know, I big resentment. I was so mad at this guy, so pissed at him, that for the next 8.5 years, I sat in 2 hours of bumper-to-bumper traffic from one side of L.A. County to the other to tell a bunch of strangers in a detox that didn't care how I stayed sober another week. And I was tricked into service. And the reason I couldn't get clean for all those years, the reason I'd suffered with untreated addiction for all those years, counting days for 17 years, is because I wasn't willing to give anything. I missed the entire point of the exercise. You know, we talk about you got to give it away to keep it, and a lot of us have said you got to give it away just to get it. It never occurred to me when Bill Wilson got out of that third treatment center in 1935. He was depressed. Sound familiar? He was driven by waves of depression. He'd lost everything in life worthwhile. And Bill Wilson got a little idea, real simple idea. Maybe if I go back in the hospital and talk to some of the patients, I'll feel better. That's all it was. He calls Dr. Silkworth. We all know Dr. Silkworth now was a double board certified physician, certified in neurology and psychiatry. At that time, he was the chief administrator and doctor of the most prominent hospital in the world that treated alcoholism and addiction. He treated addicts as well. And it says in the doctor's opinion, he says, "With all our synthetic knowledge, our ultra-modern standards, we are not well equipped." It basically says, and I wrote it in my book, "I can't fix you. Didn't you figure that out yet?" He couldn't fix him. So Silkworth says, "You want to do what, Bill?" He'd never heard of such an idea. Bill wanted to come back and talk to some of the patients. And Silkworth allowed Bill Wilson to come into that town's hospital and talk to some of those patients. And what he saw from 1935 to 1939, he said, was absolutely amazing. He was so amazed that if you look at the first endorsement in the doctor's opinion, it says you can absolutely rely on anything these men say about themselves. With a letter of credibility given to Bill Wilson by a double board certified physician. And that first piece, if you're brand new, if you don't believe in the medical estimate of this book, it wouldn't work for me. I did not understand how powerful that was. There's a poem in Notre Dame. It says, "I sought my God I could not see. I sought my soul I could not free. I sought my brother, and I found all three." That's why that seventh chapter where it says nothing ensures immunity from drinking more than intensive work with others. That fundamental idea. My sponsor said it's very much like the face of a clock. You look at those 12 numbers. When I'm in 12, I should be re-experiencing the craving with a newcomer, re-experiencing the unmanageability, re-experiencing the agnosticism, re-experiencing my resistance in the third step, re-experiencing inventory. Intimacy means into me I see. Those three words, yeah, me too. So I'll just close with this. This is one of the oldest stories you hear in the 12-step things. But this little five-year-old kid, and this little five-year-old wants to play with his dad, and the dad's like an accountant. You know those things? There used to be a thing called a map. Remember maps? They used to have a... So this dad's trying to occupy this little five-year-old boy. So what the dad does is he grabs this map of the world. Like, you know, this National Geographic, they have those great maps. And he rips this map up into like 50 pieces, and he gives it to his five-year-old son. He's trying to occupy this little boy. And he gives the kid some tape, and he says, what I want you to do, son, is I want you to put this map of the world back together. It's a little map of the world. He says, put the map of the world back together, and then we'll play. And he's thinking it's going to take this little boy an hour. This little five-year-old comes back in about 2 minutes. He's got the whole map of the world reassembled. It's perfect. The dad's like, that's impossible. 5 minutes. I couldn't do that. He says, son, how did you do that? And it's the little boy's so excited. He goes, Dad, on the back of the map of the world, there was a picture of a man. I just put the man back together, and the whole world fell into place. And in many ways, my experience with the 12 steps of DAA is exactly the same. To rebuild the man or woman. 1 through 3 with God, 4 through 7 with self through inventory, 8 and 9 with others. And then to rebuild and recreate and maintain those three simple relationships. And me, like many of us, the world automatically fell into place. It said the definition of hell is if God were to show me all the things I might have accomplished if I'd only believed in myself. If you're new, I couldn't believe in myself. I was so broken when I got here. But see, I believed in guys like Ben. I believed in the people that stood up with 37 years tonight. I believed them. And that was the beginning of change. I came to believe this could work for me too. And if you're new, I hope you might be open-minded, just like a lot of us were. I want to thank you guys for inviting me. I think I maybe overstayed my welcome. Thank you.
Oh my gosh, man! Tell me that wasn't some energy. I mean, I felt like he's in a boxing match. But, hey, man, for real, we are going to do recording and put it online because that was a lot of information. I was like, oh my gosh, that's me, it's me. And then I was like, what'd he say? I was over. I was like, I'm still over here, you know. So hey, I'm going to listen to that again because that right there was fantastic. Thank you so much. Okay. Yay.